Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. With summer well and truly hotting up, we thought it was time to look to the months ahead and see what we'll be watching, reading and exploring, possibly on our summer holidays. On the show today, I'm joined by a trio of experts on this summer's cultural offerings. For Poolside Reads, we've enlisted the help of none other than John Mitchinson, co-founder of Unbound. For the art shows that'll keep you cool, the art writer and curator Francesca Gavin is on hand. And for rainy day blockbusters, who else could we get in but Karen Krizanovich? So pull up a deck chair, grab a spritz and take notes, possibly, as we guide you through all the things you need to know over the next few months in culture. Francesca, John and Karen, welcome to the programme. Did you all know each other, by the way, before?
But now
you
do. I'm so excited.
I've met Karen.
We have, that's right, and I meant to give you back your wallet.
Okay, that's good. So we're all starting on a vaguely even keel or an uneven keel. Francesca, we're going to start with you. We're going to start with art.
Wonderful.
And we're going to sunny Germany, to Münster, which is overtaken by the sculpture world every 5 years, ten years?
Yeah. It's a decennial, which is quite exciting in the world of biennials.
Yeah.
I think that's part of the reason why Munster's so exciting this year, because obviously it was started by, in 1977, this is the fifth time it's happened. It's always curated by Kasper Koenig, and it was founded with someone from the area whose name is difficult to pronounce, Klaus Bussmann.
I thought you were just going to call him, he's really just Mr. Munster.
Yeah, Mr. Okay. Munster. Well, he is. He works for the municipality of the area. And what's so amazing about it, in Documento was really disappointing, I think, to a lot of people. It was very documentary. Venice, I think, was very disappointing to people. So Munster's been this year's sort of like holy grail of thank God there's good art in the world.
And do people kind of look to it because it's every 10 years, it can really kind of, it can plump up its pillows a little bit more, sort of, you know, with a little bit more time in hand and can be a little bit more curatorial?
I mean, it's really special, I think, the selection of what they have. I mean, this is the first time where I've been like, I have to see it, because the imagery that's been popping up, coming in particular Pierre Huyghe's installation, where he's taken over and excavated an entire ice rink and filled it with an animatronic ceiling and weird objects throughout it. It looks like a sci-fi film come to life. And that's just one of 30 different projects that are placed around the city, and which is a quite bland, strange, you know, middle of nowhere German place.
Yeah.
And I think that it just looks so exciting and feels very well produced. And I think that's what people are really drawing towards, work that's actually just really exciting and full and in depth.
And how do you explore it? I mean, is there a kind of prescribed route? Is the idea that you kind of go and you get kind of lost in the city and you see things that you kind of don't quite know whether they're sculpture or whether they're part of the city or whether they're history, whether they're the future? Do you know what I mean?
These things kind of work
quite well.
I mean, they give you a map, obviously. You can also book one of the German or English bike or walking tours.
I asked a really practical question. How do you get around, though?
Yes.
What is it, a tram?
I personally be walking, but I've been told the bike is a very good way to get around. You can rent bicycles. It's Germany. They like a bicycle.
They do. Yeah.
And they like an ice cream. So I'm sure there'll be kugels of ice cream around Germany. But I mean, the artwork is deposited around the city. So this amazing Turkish artist, Ayşe Erkmann's, created a piece where you literally feel like you're walking on the river, walking on water. Jeremy Deller's put up a big smiley face flag in the middle of somewhere's place. Yeah, we always love a bit of Jeremy.
Yeah.
But then they have Heta Sterol's done a video piece called Hell Yeah Inside, which looks really exciting. Oscar Tuazon has done this sort of, his work is very influenced by utopian architecture, and he's been doing a lot of stuff around Dakota Pipeline and Native American stuff. So he's got this almost ritualistic outdoor fire sculpture. There's younger artists like Aaron Barthol and Pele's Empire. It just looks really damn exciting.
It sounds beautiful. You talk a good game.
Very excited. Francesca, I'm actually flying to Dusseldorf and then taking the train and doing the whole thing.
When should we go to that then?
Well, it's only on for like till the beginning of September, I think. So it's on. It's the summer. It's a summer day, sort of 2 day trip.
So that is Münster, and that is on until the 1st of October. Sculptor Projector Münster, we should call it. We're going to go to the Tate Modern next. We're going to keep it close to the home, down by the river. This is called Soul of a Nation. Talk us through this one, Francesca.
This is an incredible show. I've really been looking forward to this. It's basically focusing on radical black art from the end of the Civil Rights March in like 63, I think, to 1983. So that 20 years of African-American artists, there are an incredible amount of rediscovery being made of those works internationally. I wrote a piece about this in the Financial Times recently. This idea of how museums are becoming very aware of the lacking space of African-American artists and African diaspora artists in their collections. So there are people like Betty Saar, who's a great artist working out of Los Angeles, who's, I think, veering 90, and she makes amazing assemblages that are really political, really interesting. It's just a really political, but not just political work, that's just fascinating. And I think it's a real statement that somewhere as big as the Tate Modern is doing a show of the work.
And in terms of the work itself, do you feel that you're walking around and you're being hit over the head with a political statement? Is this beautiful work that happens to be political? Are the two, can you take one and the other apart?
I think part of the pleasure of work like this, it has amazing aesthetic sort of desire around it. It's really pleasurable to look at. And yes, there's subtext and meaning within the work. And I think that makes it, it's why it's lasted so long and looks so contemporary and feels so relevant now, is that it has both. If it was lacking any of the aesthetic and felt dry, then I think it would feel, I think that's the problem with what happened with Documenta, where you ended up with works that are just a press release.
It's like reading.
And are dry. Yeah, exactly.
Because I'm reminded of a book that John talked about on this program last summer, maybe it's the autumn, Underground Railroad, which is a book that happened to be, it was a book about slavery, but also it felt like you weren't being hit over the head with it. It happened to be an amazing novel at the same time.
All good cultural things have to have elements of everything and move beyond it. You want to have something that's universal. If it's just referring to a specific political moment in time, then it's going to be dated and fade. We're not looking at Charterist posters today in the same way, are we?
Yeah, exactly.
You never know.
Yeah. Okay, Soul of a Nation, as recommended by Francesca Gavin, it's on at the Tate Modern. It's a big summer show there. It's on until the 22nd of October. We've got time to squeeze in Chart. It's an art fair. It's in Copenhagen. Why should we be buying stuff in Copenhagen? It's an interesting one because Scandinavia's never had a big art fair. Right?
No, and that's what's kind of wonderful about it. I mean, I did a project there a couple of years ago, so I'm a bit biased because I loved working there.
Yeah.
And it's also an incredible opportunity for people to go to Copenhagen and see Louisiana. And there's a huge amount of younger project spaces opening up in the city. What's so great about Chart is that it's a perfect-sized art fair. It's quite small. It's within beautiful Charlottenburg Museum space in the sort of like Regency sort of square filled with things.
And it's not too big then as well, right?
It's not too big at all. And they also have a really good opening concert. They had Peaches play last time. And they're very much about having like a social aspect. They have a big emerging section coming up for this year. But what's so interesting is they take galleries from Iceland and Denmark and Norway and Sweden and Finland. So it's got this breadth of the Scandinavian sort of different kind of work.
So it's a bit of a survey
everywhere.
Show of what's happening rather than...
Yeah, and there's really interesting work coming out of those countries and some really great younger galleries. So I think it's... And quite established galleries too, but I think it's really nice seeing a focus on a region. And I think those countries are, let's say, suffering a little bit less, well, perhaps not Iceland, than a lot of the other spaces in Southern Europe, let's say, at this moment in time. So I think it's quite smart of them to be creating a fair that's showing the art coming out of the spaces. There's some really great galleries. I personally really like V1 out of Denmark. Yeah. They're really kind of wild and fun. OSL Contemporary out of Norway are really interesting, really varied work. And then there's some like really well-established spaces like Bjo Bjergard. I mean, it's five gallerists who begun actually doing the fair, and it's them as coming together to create it. So it's quite an unusual. It's an unusual art fair that feels closer to an exhibition.
Francesca Gavin, thank you so much for talking us through your three greatest hits of arts summer. And by the way, we should tell people that Chart in Copenhagen is on from the 1st until the 13th of September. And before that, Soul of a Nation at the Tate Modern. And before that, Sculptor Projector at Munster. People will be writing in about my strange accent. But no umlauts on there to trip over. Sometimes I feel more at home with an umlaut.
Yeah. But cozy that, umlauts.
The cozy umlaut, Münster.
Yes.
Right?
Don't ask me, I'm terrible.
Sounds like a band. Yeah. The cozy umlauts.
Cozy umlauts.
You know, before I even knew there was an umlaut sound, I was pronouncing the German word for art completely wrong.
It is my favourite word.
It's a good word, isn't it? An artist is always a Künstler.
Yeah.
Always good.
Talking of Künstlers,
talking of the flaming umlauts, John Mitchinson, what have you got up your literary sleeve this summer? Thank you for coming in.
I was delighted to be here. I thought we'd
don't say it like that. We mean it this side of the desk.
I thought we'd kick off with just pure pleasure, which is the latest, in fact, the eighth novel by John Niven, comic novelist, the writer of the brilliant, the jet black satire, Kill Your Friends.
Yeah.
And this new book, which is called No Good Deed, is kind of, he does two kinds of books. He does a sort of high concept. He did a brilliant book about golf in Scotland called The Amateurs, and a book about the Second Coming called The Second Coming, where Christ comes back as the winner of a reality TV show with the character Stephen Stelfox, the dark genius from playing the Simon Cowell character. And then he also does kind of state of the nation, sort of more Martin Amis-y type comedies, of which Straight White Male was probably the most obvious. This is kind of a mix of both. It starts with a brilliant premise, I think. Man steps over tramp outside Groucho. Tramp says, "Hi, Alan." The guy stepping over is Alan Granger, a food critic, a restaurant reviewer, enjoying an extremely happy kind of family life. And the tramp says, "Hello, Alan." And it turns out to be a man he was in a band with many years ago who is now a tramp.
He takes some Niven types here already. It sounds good.
You can feel it coming.
Yeah.
They go and have a drink in the pub. Obviously, he's a bit smelly. They drink four pints and they go to the Groucho. Still a bit smelly, but he pretends he's a contemporary artist.
And then he makes
a series of misjudgments. The big misjudgment, as it turns out, is he invites him back to the house. Ooh. And then offers to really try and see if he can help him get his life back together. Craig, who is the incubus, the tramp, then proceeds to basically destroy Alan's life.
Amazing.
And unravels in the way that only Niven can do. There's a fabulous scene that Alan's wife comes from a very wealthy family, and between Alan and Craig, they manage to block the cistern in the toilet of the big country house that the wife's dad owns, and there's kind of a cascade of shit, literal and metaphorical, going down the stairs. But Craig is Iago, you know. It's like, dude, why? All I've done is try to be kind and generous to you. And I guess this is the thing. He's a funny writer, but there's a seriousness in Niven. And I think, you know, that kind of Amis side to Niven, coming out that idea that male friendships in particular really struggle to get out of the pattern that are laid down when you're teenagers.
Still sort of competitive. Yeah. Yeah. I thought it was really interesting what he's talking about, because I know he's based in L.A. now, isn't he?
High Wycombe when he's not in L.A.
how often does he come back?
He's back quite a bit.
Is he back? Because I always think that his stuff
screen,
is always...
He's doing a lot of screenwriting.
He used to be called Low Wycombe before John moved
If you follow him on Twitter, I mean, he's astonishing.
Particularly the tennis.
Yeah, he's brilliant on Murray.
His job is to mine new depths to which the kind of profanatory capacity of English can go. And he's a genius for that. Although it has cost him, he was given very stern reprimand by J.K. Rowling a couple of weeks ago over his election coverage, which was kind of perhaps a fatal confusion of the language of his Andy Murray and golf commentaries with political insight. But he's on his day, and this is a really funny novel. There is no funnier writer, I think, in the UK at the moment.
It is John Niven. It is called No Good Deed. Yes, I'm getting a whiff of the information there.
There are a couple of name checks. Amusing name checks that people will.
And we're on different ground for your next one, John. It's Lucy Hughes Hallett. It's called Peculiar Ground. This seems to have a whiff of psychogeography of all sorts of different things.
This is just completely different from Niven. This is a big, capacious first novel. I don't know whether of 65, Lucy's first novel is a record, but she's known as a biographer. I mean, a few years ago, she won both a Costa and the Samuel Johnson for her biography of Gabriel D'Annunzio called The Pike, which was, I mean, a brilliant story about a complicated and fairly repellent human being. But she told that story with the same kind of flair, I guess, she brings to this book. This book is the story, essentially, of an English estate, a country house, which sounds like it might be the dullest thing in the world, but she's such a good writer, and she approaches it in such an interesting way. It starts in the aftermath of the Civil War. There is the plan to turn Wychwood, this Oxfordshire estate, into a model. I mean, I live in Oxfordshire. I know a little bit about the history, and she mines that history brilliantly. But to tell a story about the idea of creating paradise, and the damage that building any kind of wall does, and indeed the story of the architect John Norris and his plans for the impartment comes at the cost, obviously, of a lot of the local people who are. So there's a political tension at the beginning. You then leap forward 300 years to the beginning of the 60s when the Berlin Wall is being put up, and there is a house party that it's gone out of the family's hands, and it's now a kind of a cool London couple running the place, and lots of bohemian kind of goings on. But one of the things I love, she does that quite a lot of the people who are descended from servants are still on the estate, still work to the estate, and some of the names of the pets have been passed on.
Right.
So there is this kind of, you, then there's another big leap in the narrative to the end of the 70s and then the final bit in 1989, where they are, the house is now having to be open to visitors and they're having to put on a rock concert at the cost, really, of the sort of the beautiful vision. There's so much going on in this novel.
This
so many
like
characters. There literally is three pages of a dramatis personae at the beginning of it.
Could you, I mean, you knew that Lucy Hughes Hallett was a biographer before she was a novelist. Do you get a sense of that, having to put history in this linear order?
I think Michael Holroyd, the biography, once said that instead of having 19th century novels, now we have biographies, because people love that idea of a family saga. And in a way, this book is a perfect example of that. It's completely involving. Despite yourself, you want to know. I mean, she balances out. It might sound like a kind of escape. It's not escapist fantasy. The building of the Berlin Wall, the taking down of the Berlin Wall. It really, really, I don't suppose she even planned that it should come out a year after Brexit. But it feels oddly relevant. If you want a beach read that tests your mind a little bit, along with the pre-mentioned Colson Whitehead and the great Lincoln and the Bardo by George Saunders, this is the third book that I've read this year that I think is a really exceptional and deserves to win prizes, I think.
Beautiful. Well, thanks, John. It's Peculiar Ground. It's by Lucy Hughes Hallett. It's out now. Finally, Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, The Fact of a Body, a Murder and a Memoir. This is a true crime book.
It's a true crime.
But with a whiff of quite a lot of difference about it.
Yeah, well, if you're looking for the kind of the analogue equivalent to Serial or S-Town or The Great Untold, which is my new favourite podcast, if you're looking for that kind of forensic, trying to understand why terrible things happen in the world, and this is the core of this book, is the murder of a six-year-old child, Jeremy Guillory, by a jug-eared misfit in Iowa in the early 90s. But what makes that so it could be, I guess, the book references Midnight and the Good of Evil, Garden of Good and Evil by John Berendt. Truman Capote will always come up. Kind of a bit, I sort of don't feel it is quite either of those books. It's its own thing. What makes it special and remarkable is that she's working as a young lawyer in New Orleans, and she sees the tape of the confession of the murderer. And, she's obviously a young, idealistic lawyer working for a charity against the death penalty. And she finds herself possessed with a deep, visceral kind of need to see this man put to death, the guy who's confessed to the child murder, and she doesn't really understand where this comes from. It turns out that where it comes from, insofar as you can ever, and the book's brilliant about this, about the complex kind of interplay of things that make us feel the things we feel, is that she was abused by her grandfather, who she loved as a child. It's incredibly powerful, difficult to read, very difficult to read. The precision with which she describes both, the unfolding of the murder, but also the unfolding of her abuse is powerful. And it's a book that doesn't pull its punches. It is a page turner. This is not a particularly comforting book for anybody who's been through trauma.
Read on sunny day.
But if you want to have something to talk about in the evenings, around the campfire.
Yeah.
Given a trigger warning to any of your books before. That's wild.
Yeah.
Well, no, but it's real. It's real stuff.
It's real stuff. Yeah.
It's called The Fact of a Body, a Murder and a Memoir, and it's by Alexandria Marzano-Lesnovich, and as recommended by John Mitchinson. John, thank you very much for your choices, which were also Lucy Hughes Hallett's Peculiar Ground and John Niven's No Good Deed. It's film time, Karen Krasanovich. Where on earth are we going first? We've got some clips lined up. Should we blast into Dunkirk first?
Let's do that.
Let's do it.
He's coming back round!
Where are we going?
Dunkirk.
I'm not going back.
There's no hiding from this, son. We have a job to do.
If we go there, we'll die.
Okay, that's Christopher Nolan's Dunkirk. It's out on the 21st of July.
Now, everybody's really excited about this because Christopher Nolan is such a grump, and he's such a precisionist, and he always likes to play with time, which, of course, is cinema's strongest element and also its most difficult. This is, thankfully, and I don't know if anybody had a word with him, his shortest film yet.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
1 hour 47. Not that we're counting. I'm the person that eats all the popcorn during the trailer, so there, it doesn't help me. Right, we've got Tom Hardy, Fionn Whitehood, Cillian Murphy, and Kenneth Branagh, among others, in this not historical drama that's inspired by the three strands of Dunkirk, sea, air, and land. I was going to say the other thing. Yeah. and he's saying it's not a war movie, and it's shot mostly, well, almost, what is that, 90% or 70% shot on IMAX cameras, which are notoriously noisy.
Okay.
So who knew? It's kind of, there's this grinding.
Luckily, there's enough explosions to.
Well, apparently, it's also the closest he's come to making a silent film. But what really excites me about this, like, you know, lots of sound editing, lots of stuff going on. And it's also present tense narrative. And I think as sort of, I mean, that's been very popular lately with various films. But also, I think what's interesting is that he went to the BFI South Bank here in London and he chose 11 film inspirations for this movie and showed them, which I thought was great. All Quiet on the Western Front, which you would expect. Foreign Correspondent. But also things like Speed and Unstoppable.
Okay.
You notice that it wasn't Speed 2.
Yeah, right.
It was Speed 1.
Fast and the Furious 8.
And he goes, and it, really the point of this is that he goes, it's not a historical lesson. This is about, are they going to survive?
Okay.
And I think that's what's exciting about
it. So does it feel,
to
make a non-historical film about a famous piece of history, fair enough. I mean, maybe Napoleon might have been like that if you ever finished it. But does it feel like making light of history? Is there some sense where you go inspired by actual events? Yeah. That's okay if it's a car chase, but when it's Dunkirk, how does it come off?
Well, he's probably witnessed this in his cynical self, and this is completely wrong, but I'm going to say it anyway. That he's just waiting for everybody who's actually involved to die off. Then he can tell his story, and nobody's going to object.
Okay.
No, I'm just kidding. it's the truth of fiction, basically. If you were, I mean, you're talking about factual things. He has to make a narrative that's interesting, and he has to make something that's going to involve us emotionally. So I think the fact that he says it's not a documentary is okay. People are going to argue, you know, like, that didn't happen. But I think the point is people are going to be punched in the gut by this. They're going to realize what actually happened there. And I think it's going to be terrific. So it's rightfully we're all excited by it.
So we've got a stellar cast here: Tom Hardy, Cillian Murphy, Mark Rylance, whose voice I recognise on the clip there, Kenneth Branagh, some fairly decent talent in it. Harry Styles, who apparently is quite good in it. That's the fifth name on my little list.
People can.
Who
act.
Knew he'd be a good solo pop star? It's true.
Well, it depends on the director and how they feel and how they're prepped and how they're handled.
Yeah.
You know. So yeah.
Dunkirk is out on the 21st of July, as recommended by Karen Krasanovich. The DVD will, of course, include a two-pack featuring Speed 2. The Beguiled, Sofia Coppola.
Won Best Director at the Cannes Film Festival with a Clint Eastwood, Don Siegel remake. The Beguiled. Yeah. A wonderful cast, as you would expect. Colin Farrell as a soldier who's found by a group of women. And automatically you're thinking, Russ Meyer needs to remake this. No. Colin Farrell, and he's discovered by
Valley of the Federal Super Vixens, right?
Yes. We have to throw Ultra in there somewhere. Una Lawrence, Nicole Kidman, Elle Fanning, and another, I mean, really a terrific, Kirsten Dunst, really terrific group of women that are looking after him, nursing him. And I love that Anthony Lane says in The New Yorker, when he says, it's just like, James Caan being trapped by Kathy Bates. And I'm like, no, it's not.
No, yeah. It's not.
But the interesting thing about this is we're with the remake, and it's like comparing art to books to film. I mean, they're all different media. But the remake was sort of like the women were sort of nervous and kind of, you know, dysfunctional, kind of operating on their ovaries. Here, the women are kind of, you know, they're a little wiser, but they're also incredibly clean and well-pressed. And you're thinking, no, wait a minute. This is sort of happening during the war, Civil
Sophia
War.
Coppola's got her kind of...
You've only got one slave here who's got an interesting role.
Yeah.
But you think, oh, come on.
Yeah. But she's got a bit Prada.
A little bit, yeah. I mean, obviously, there's a dry cleaner around the corner, just over the border. just ignore those terrible guys in the blue outfits. But it's interesting, and I think Coppola's a very interesting, fresh director, and I think she deserves the prize at Cannes. And I think this is a beautiful, very interesting film with a twist in the tail.
Well, let's play a clip and see what, yeah. see Colin, poor Colin, being brought into the house of the, what was not ill repute before he turned
up. The least menacing guy on earth, yeah. Glenn.
Can I get you anything?
Give me the key.
You know I'd get in trouble for that.
I thought it was just drums and whispering, but that was really... I'm going to go and see that now. Yeah, it sounds great. It's out on the 14th of July. It's The Beguiled. Yeah,
but you don't know Coppola. At the end, they just shaved him. So there I am.
It was Movember!
Oh, it took me forever!
I can imagine that feeling.
We're going to finish with The Big Sick.
Yeah.
This is a kind of rom-com... Should I say with a difference? I don't know whether... I mean, yeah, are there any without one
it
these
is
days?
With a difference.
Tell
it's
us about The Big
by
Sick.
Michael Showalter, generally writer, television director, pretty much, with Kumail Nanjiani, I hope I'm saying the name right, who is a stand-up comedian. And he also co-wrote this with his, the spoiler alert, wife, Emily, who's played by Zoe Kazan. This is the story of a basically a Pakistani-American guy. There's a Uber driver. He's trying to break through with his comedy. And his parents keep... setting him up with all of these sort of suitable Muslim brides.
Yeah.
And you really feel sorry for them because it's like they don't want to be there either. The parents are like... and he ends up falling in love with, you know, a white woman, you know, which is, you know, shouldn't do. And her parents couldn't be whiter, actually. Ray Romano, well, I don't know, he's Italian, I guess, isn't he, or something? wait a minute, that's white? What am I saying? I don't know. Anyway, I'm living in Britain, it doesn't matter. Holly Hunter. And it, the interesting thing about this is that they fall in love and they realize that it can never work because he's got to, you know, his parents are pressuring him. They're going to disown him, which is kind of weird. And yet then she gets into an accident. She's put into a coma and he goes, despite her parents going, what are you doing here? Feels like he has to sit by her bed. And I think what's interesting about that is sort of this idea of unsuitability, but also this click when you click with someone and you can't let go, even though you're unsuitable. And it's just like that wonderful thing in Corinthians. I'll throw some Christianity in there. Corinthians 14, and love tolerates all things. And it's actually really, really quite lovely. It's very funny. There's some wonderful, wonderful comments on culture and American culture, particularly because it's so messed up. I think it's really worth seeing.
Let's have a little clip then. This is
the big... It is a comedy, by the way.
Sick.
Yes.
I've been dating this girl. She's white.
A white girl?
Okay, you can't look like you and yell white girl.
It's okay. We hate terrorists.
Are you judging Pakistan's next hot model?
You know how we have arranged marriage in my culture?
Oh my god, I'm so stupid. Can you imagine a world in which we end up together?
I don't know.
I'm looking for Emily Gardner. She was checked in tonight.
There's an infection. We put her in a medically induced coma.
Coma.
You should call her family.
Thank you, Kamala. We're going to handle things from here.
I think I'm just going to wait anyway.
You guys broke up. I'm not sure why you're here.
Okay, it's The Big Sick from director Michael Showalter featuring Kumail Nanjiani, Zoe Kazan, Holly Hunter. That's out on the 28th of July. Before that, we talked about The Beguiled, out on the 14th from Sofia Coppola, and Christopher Nolan's take on Dunkirk, out on the 21st of July.
It's an interesting year.
It's quite a decent... It's shaping up to be a decent summer.
It is. There's a lot of Stephen King, if you're into Stephen King, by the way. But we won't talk about it. We don't have time for that.
Okay, we'll do a separate whole... We'll do it. I mean, the DVD 3.
Great.
DVD 3. That's after Speed 2. We'll have the Stephen King hour. Francesca, John, and Karen, thank you very much for sharing your summer read, your summer art must visits, and for the rainy days, the cinema as well. Thank you very much. We've all got a busy summer ahead of us, noting down those greatest hits of yours. That brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was, of course, Holly Fisher, and I've been Robert Bound. Join us at the same time next week, but for the time being, thanks for tuning in.